So I want to begin with a little recap of some of the points that were made or ideas that we've been discussing up until now in this realm of engaged Buddhism, and in particular these few talks that I'm giving on service in the realm of environmental care. And last week I spoke about the sense of overwhelm and despair that can happen when one is doing this sort of work, or any form of social engagement for that matter. And then when that sense of overwhelm and burnout or not begins to take over, then you find yourself becoming kind of disengaged or stepping back, giving up. Stop thinking about the problem, right? So it's really important when that begins to happen. You know, those are symptoms, basically. And they're the result of looking at the problem or interacting with the issues in a certain way. And it's a way that's familiar in the teachings of the Buddha, because all those emotions that I just got through describing are reflective, right? They cause pain, they cause suffering. Yeah, Bill, if there's a way you can shut down the AC, that would be nice for the time being. So I don't know if anyone else can and knows how to do that, but all right, good, very good. If possible, great. Otherwise, I'll just keep belting it out. As I was saying last week, when those feelings come on, and they come on for me too, they are symptomatic, afflictive emotions, insofar as the teachings of the Buddha are concerned, that result from seeing the situation you're working with from the perspective of self. Seeing the situation from the perspective of an individual person in this one lifetime. And that's it. And in order to work skillfully with those emotions when they arise, it's really important to develop an alternative view or an alternative way of looking at the situation that is not so self-oriented, that is not so self-referential. The most important means of doing so in this tradition that we're a part of and that we practice. Right, okay. Silence, okay. The most important quality of mind is mindfulness itself. Like the analogy that I was using, the teachings of Bhikkhu Anālayo a few meetings ago. In the old days, there was this, and this was the way the Buddha was taught mindfulness meditation. It's kind of like a security camera. You train the mind to kind of hold up a mirror to whatever is going on in the discursive mind and just watch it and label it and watch everything kind of come and go. And then you finally start to get in sync with the notion that all arises must pass away. The Buddha's take on mindfulness practice, however, is different. And the simile that Bhikkhu Anālayo uses, rather than there being a security camera at the playground watching the kids, your mindfulness practice is like a kind and loving parent. Okay. So you're letting the kids play and do their thing and not interfering with their activities unless it's clear to you that they're about to harm themselves or others. And then some kind of intervention can be skillful, can be useful. Other than that, in this practice, it's to simply observe whatever it is the mind's up to. Whether the mind happens to be feeling joyous and open at the time, or whether it's feeling angry or afraid or despairing, it's able to watch what is happening in the mind from a perspective of kindness and compassion. It's what Ram Dass calls watching the mind with the heart. You know? And so it's that practice in and of itself that can initiate the process of standing back and looking at the situation from a perspective not that of the individual self, not that of the individual who is feeling the despair or the anger or the fear or just the sense of contraction, right? How do we go about doing that? One of the means of doing so, above and beyond the simple practice of mindfulness itself, is to have alternative ways of thinking or alternative contexts within which you can place the situation. And one of those is what I'm going to talk about this evening. And that perspective, well, there's a couple of the principle one I want to talk about this evening, is something called the Gaia principle, or the Gaia perspective. In Buddha Dharma, one of the real problems that we find in translating the teachings of the Buddha from the first language they were written down in, which is Pali, into English has got to do with the very nature of the structure of the English language. Okay. And most of the Romance languages as well, for that matter. Subject, verb, object. Okay. And we organize our world in that way. I am looking at things. Right? At its root, in the view of the teachings of the Buddha, there actually are no nouns. There are no subjects and there are no objects. All there is verbs in the present tense. So basically all there are gerunds, ings. That which we think of as things, that which we think of as myself, me and you, and St. Barnabas Church and the seats that we're sitting on and whatnot, even though they seem solid and permanent, they are all actually processes. So if first, you know, you'll notice that when I'm talking about, even though most teachers say the breath, watch the breath, basically there's no such thing as the breath. You know, it's not a thing, it's a process. It's the process of respiration. Okay. So, although it sounds a little awkward, oftentimes people who are teaching the Dharma out of the Pali Canon, you'll hear us use the term mind-body process, right? Which is actually much more in keeping with the way the Buddha taught the nature of mind and the body within which it resides at this stage of the game. So, looking at this mind-body process, okay, just in terms of its physicality, right, the average adult human body is made up of about 40 trillion cells. 70 trillion, if you count the bacteria in the alimentary canal, nutrition system from one end to the other. That's a lot of cells, right? And furthermore, they're not permanent. They are being born and dying at the rate of about 700,000 a second. And that goes on continuously. Different organs of the body, including the skin and the blood and whatnot, they replicate at different rates. On average, the human body in adulthood completely replicates itself about every 7 years. Okay. So we who like to think of ourselves as permanent or unchanging or me, or whatnot, we are actually simply this flow, this bioenergetic flow. Is this going on and on and on until, of course, it's not? Okay. How does this relate to the Gaia principle? Well, Gaia is a name from Greek mythology, and it's the Earth Mother who gave birth to the parents of the Olympians. Okay. The term was coined in this particular context in the 1970s, first by a chemist named James Lovelock, soon to be joined by a molecular biologist named Lynn Margulis. And the idea behind the Gaia perspective, and when I was in my undergraduate years in the 1960s and 1970s, earning a bachelor's of environmental science at Berkeley, they were just now beginning to think of, you know, that was the decade in which the first course on ecology was taught at that particular university anyway. And it was the beginning of the popularization or the rapid expansion of the view of everything that's going on in the environment from a systems perspective. Okay. And from the perspective of multiple interactive spheres of existence. So we have the geosphere, you know, the crust of the Earth itself. Have the hydrosphere, all the surface water on the Earth, all the groundwater inside the Earth. Okay. We have the biosphere, the tiny skin of living organisms that encompass the globe, okay, on all land surfaces and in the oceans. Okay. Above that is the atmosphere, okay, and above that the ionosphere. So we would study these different systems from a spherical systems perspective. Okay. And then, just as importantly, we would study the interactions between them all. The interactions between the Earth and living organisms. Okay. And the critical role that the hydrosphere plays in making all that possible. Relationship between the hydrosphere and the atmosphere. Okay, water on and in the Earth, and then as it rises up into the heavens. Okay. So we started paying more and more attention to these bioenergetic exchanges that are constantly going on within and between all of these various spheres. What Lovelock posited when he looked at that, he saw that all of these systems interact pretty much anywhere on the globe you happen to be, in a way represented by what at the time was called dynamic stasis, which is to say all of these systems interacting amongst each other over the long haul tend towards balance and stability. But it's a dynamic balance, and so it's never static, it's never just one thing, okay? So there's this continuous process of dynamic stasis going on, you know, constant change, but change within bounds, self-regulating change. Okay. So for instance, the human body has this capacity, as do all mammals and many other animal species, It has all of these self-regulatory mechanisms at work, okay, including our ability to adjust our heart rate depending on levels of activity, our rate of respiration, and temperature regulation. If we're too hot or too cold, things the body tries to do to regain some sense of dynamic stasis, so the body's temperature is returned to a safe one for functioning properly and staying healthy. What Lovelock noticed and what he theorized is that, in his view, the Earth in its entirety behaves like one living thing. that the same interactive and self-regulating systems are in play. Okay. And that in the interactions of all of these systems and the way they react to each other's, to changes in each system, and the way it changes brings about changes in the other systems, and then how entire ecosystems can adjust to change circumstances in the atmosphere or the hydrosphere, availability of nutrients, in order to find another sense of stasis. That oftentimes include things like a bunch of species going extinct, others mutating, and new ones coming into existence. It's this kind of ongoing process. You know, about as far as we can tell, about 95% to 98% of all species that ever lived have gone extinct. And a lot of that happened even before we came around. You know, we just seem to be playing a role in accelerating that process right now because of changes that we are in the process of initiating in the environment that actually have never existed, at least not in the lifespan of human beings. So, for a while, this idea attracted a lot of fascination and a lot of talk, and then people started kind of poking holes in it, and then there was more theorizing going on and deeper study of the interactions of all these systems, and more, it is once again gaining salience as a useful way to look at how the Earth as one organism functions, how it seeks to take care of itself, how it seeks to perpetuate life, and the ways that its self-regulatory systems work. Okay. All similes have their limitations, of course. But one interesting one that is out and about in terms of looking at the human role and what's going on with regard to challenges to the dynamic stasis that the Earth tries to generally live under has got to do certainly with mammals. Okay. One of the strategies that mammals have developed over the course of a few million years, a way of dealing with potentially lethal pathogens. Okay. If the immune system is not initially successful in warding off infection, okay, then one of the things the body will do is to run a fever. And the purpose of the fever is a strategy for trying to kill off the pathogen without killing off the host. And sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't, right? But that's one of the strategies that this human body came up with over the course of a very long period of time as a means of seeking to rid the body of pathogens. So before we knew much about antibiotics or viruses for that matter and how to work with them in terms of medications, all that could really happen was symptomatic treatment. And when it could only hope that the fever would run its course and do its job while not irreparably damaging or killing off the body in which the fever was raging. Okay. And sometimes yes, sometimes no. Okay. But it's a survival strategy. Okay. The simile being posited there is that just as the human body, and it tries to kill off pathogens that are threatening the well-being of the body, usually in the pathogen is oftentimes because of its excretory activities, you know, with the inflammation caused by the harmful bacteria's functioning. Looking at it from that standpoint, one can analogize the Earth now beginning to run a fever in order to kill off pathogens. Unfortunately, the causative agent is us. We are the pathogens. Okay. We are the very ones that are threatening dynamic stasis in the biosphere, with the result that if you take the Gaia hypothesis seriously, the Earth is simply trying to take care of itself. It's trying to do what is possible in order to maintain dynamic stasis in the biosphere. Okay. And if there is one species that is having the effect of disturbing that effort, for a very long time now, the Earth has been very good at getting rid of that pathogen. So, what do we do about that? Viewed from this perspective, we have been kind of born into a form of environmental involuntary servitude, in that we have been born into a civilization, into a society, okay, that is dependent upon carbon-based energy systems. And it's carbon-based energy systems and our utilization of them that is in fact causing the Earth to run the fever. It's involuntary servitude because we understand the dynamic and we understand the importance of doing everything possible to halt the inflammation, to halt the pathogenic behavior. And we're beginning to make efforts in that direction. But we have a really long ways to go in a really short period of time. Carrying on with the analogy, if there is an affliction on the body of Gaia, and one of the strategies may be running a fever, you know, and the problem that's threatening dynamic stasis is us, then what saves the body, what saves the human body when you're running a fever, and what potentially is going to save, you know, the return to dynamic stasis within Gaia, is the action of the immune system, right? Antibodies. So looked at from that perspective, we all spend a part of our time, you know, in terms of having driven here tonight and the energy taken to run the AC and whatnot in our own homes and our cooking. We spend part of our time being involuntary pathogens. But a lot of us also do everything we can to spend some of our time as well being antibodies. Doing what we can to move away from carbon-based energy systems. Looking at ways we can modify our behavior that involve using less energy, period. Or when we do need to use energy, seeking to do it through reliance on renewable sources instead. And that's exactly what's going on technologically, it's what's going on politically, it's what's going on socially. Okay. It's us looking at and taking responsibility for the way we live on Earth and the way we do or don't serve the health of the planet, which means the way we do or do not serve ourselves, each other, and all sentient beings. Okay. So we're waking up to realizing, having a hard look at the pathogenic effects of some of our behaviors as global humankind, that right now we do not have the power to stop with sufficient will and with sufficient understanding and sufficient collective action. We can start shifting away from pathogenic behavior and more towards healthy behaviors, behaviors that instead restore the immune system and protect the biosphere, that protect all life on Earth. Okay. So that's one way of understanding the situation that we find ourselves in right now. Taken from this perspective, okay, it's like, say, well, what can I do? You know, I'm one cell in the pancreas. Well, what if every cell in the pancreas had that attitude? Lethal diabetes is what would happen, right? So we are all part of this thing that is much greater than ourselves. And cells, especially if they're afflicted by viruses, they're attacked one at a time. So one way to continue to, you know, take this analogy is that when you find yourself falling into despair, or find yourself falling into contraction, into utter withdrawal. Okay, it's a little the same as going dead. Going dead is a self. So part of the challenge for us is, how do we stay alive? How do we stay vital? Okay. And the way that we do that is through interaction with other healthy tissue, okay, with others who are trying to do the same thing, who are trying to basically care for and save life on Earth. Even though most climate models tell us that if we don't pretty soon start changing in a major way the energy systems we're dependent upon, things are going to get very rough. And there is going to be a lot of die-off of species, especially the most heat-intolerant ones. And unfortunately, that includes us. So there is indeed the possibility, the distinct possibility, that humankind is going to suffer enormously over the next century or so. Okay. And whether or not that suffering is survivable by us as a species really has to do with how quickly we can shift from being pathogens to being antibodies. Okay. And that is the great adventure in which we're currently embarked. Okay. So there's more I want to add, but before doing so, I'd just like to put it out there and say, well, how does this sound to you? You know, does it resonate? Do you find it hopeful or despairing? <You know? laughs> What's it like to kind of put on that set of ideas, see what it feels like to look at our situation from that view? Please.
I have a couple of things. One of them is that you may have had a very positive thing happen with regards to the climate change deniers. David Koch died, and he was one of his money driven the climate change denier thing as much as anybody in the world.
The carbon-based energy system industries around the world, and there's a series in the New York Times recently, I think it was, about the Adani Group in India, and they're this, you know, it's a billionaire that owns this corporation, but basically the deals they're making now are going to ensure continued reliance on burning coal for energy in India and the rest of the developing world for the next 30 years, signed a deal to do a massive open pit coal mine in Australia and then ship all the coal over to India. And so they're planning to advance their economy through the combustion of coal for the next 30 years. Okay. Which is one of the reasons, not the only one. Certainly we're basically doing the same thing here in the United States right now, insofar as with the same thing, the facilitation of in support of the carbon-based energy systems industry by the current governmental administration. So that's something that really kind of needs, it's not just the Koch folks, it's everybody who's got skin in the game of carbon-based energy systems. They are gonna go down swinging, you know, and hopefully they do before we do. But it's a real horse race right now, that's for sure. One of the ways of kind of trying to head that one off at the pass, if the wealthiest countries in the world would be willing to do so, would be to simply put billions and billions of dollars into solarizing the entire country of India, doing it just as fast as possible for the purpose of saving humankind, you know. And that would take, it would be an enormous wealth transfer, and doing the same thing in China, right? But it basically allows a developing country to skip that whole period of historical development that included reliance upon carbon-based energy systems, you know, through the industrial age. And understandably, the developing world is saying, well, let me see, do I have this right? You spent the last 200 years threatening the earth while you were making yourselves very rich. And now you're very rich, and you don't want us to do the same thing that you did in order for us to get rich as well. So for them, it looks kind of like a recipe for eternal poverty, right? And so the way to get around that, instead of making them take loans out from the, you know, the World Bank or whatever, is to simply do a revolutionary act of kindness and generosity, which is to simply say, flood those developing countries with whatever amount of wealth is needed in order to allow them to completely skip carbon-based energy systems in the development of their economies. It's doable, but it involves an enormous wealth transfer. And it's one that so far the richest nations in the world have not been willing to undertake. But it's a it's there. It's a possibility. It's something that could be done, you know, if we decide we want to. We as a global community. Thank you. Yeah. Please.
I was thinking there's some interesting ethical implications in the Gaia hypothesis. There's a great art essay by E.O. Wilson about the relative value of humans versus, well, bugs. You know, he points out we have a dismissive attitude toward insects and bugs, but the fact is there are several of those without whom the earth would die. We, on the other hand, not only don't contribute anything, we do a lot of harm. So it seemed like we really wanted to do the right thing. We don't do a mass lemming routine and run into the ocean or something.
Good point. He tells a story about having taken some people on a nature walk, and he was pointing out some of the different life forms, including the insects, and somebody on the tour asked, well, what good is it? And his response to the question was, well, what good are you? You know, the person wanted to know whether, you know, did it perform some useful function, or was there, you know, some kind of commercial upside to having that bug around? So, well, that's an interesting perspective. Yeah, please don't.
Well, I've been thinking, sort of looking at it from a little more hopeful perspective.
Yes.
Number one, it seems to me that our parting gift to the planet is the current political administration. Now, I'm talking about the baby boomers.
Yeah.
That's our final gift. But we're rapidly coming to a point where it's no longer possible to deny that things are changing.
Yes.
This is the hottest summer I can remember in Colorado.
Yeah.
And, you know, these extreme weather patterns and that kind of thing.
Yep.
The Amazon burning,
yep,
all of this. But generally what we see is that, I mean, this administration is like really far to the right of this issue. But politics has a kind of pendulum.
Yes.
And I have the feeling that the combination of realization that this is not, we're not kidding here, it's really happening, and just plain damn tired of what we've been seeing in our politics, right, that there's going to be a radical shift in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is a hopeful sign.
Thank you. I appreciate you adding that perspective. When I'm looking for reliable, authoritative information on what's going on with regard to climate change, and a lot of it out there is pretty alarmist. And the question then arises, if you're not a scientist, well, to what extent is that really warranted? I mostly look to the modeling done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And what they've done is to create these four general pathways or scenarios, representative carbon pathways, I think they're called. And they're saying, looking at all the variables that are going into climate change right now, what are the ones, if they are unchanged, will lead to this outcome, versus what are some of the ones, if they are changed, will lead to different outcomes. And of those four scenarios, only one of them is the worst case scenario, you know, with the melting of the permafrost and runaway warming, uncontrollable warming, okay. That scenario is based on humankind doing absolutely nothing and just continuing on business as usual. The reason that we're getting so many alarmist headlines right now is that right now that's what's happening. You know, carbon buildup in the atmosphere is continuing to go on. The other pathways that they posit are ones where in the near future, just exactly what you said happens. Things get really, really bad. And a lot of people get really, really freaked out. And they realize that, you know, oligarchic capitalism and carbon-based energy systems and their stranglehold on the global economy has got to end. It's just got to stop. And that will begin to happen. It'll begin to happen at an accelerating rate. And the transition to renewable energy economies and the wealth transfer necessary to start at least capping, leveling off the buildup of CO2 and then gradually starting to bring it down again is a viable possibility. And it's actually, of the four scenarios, three of them have that occurring, actually. There's only one that feels that humanity will have lost all capacity for righting the ship and for taking care of things. They think that's actually less likely. You know. But again, right now we're on the worst case trajectory, and that obviously has to change. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Please, Luke.
I was reading recently, Russia's economy is primarily based on production of oil and gas.
Absolutely.
Economically, but so they've been in the climate denier kind of category, but recently Putin talked about, you know, that there's been really radical changes in Siberia and across Russia, and now they're going, hey, we need to do something about it, which is really a major shift for
it. Is. You know. It really is. Yeah. Okay. So, this idea of the necessity of seeking a means of finding a vantage point other than the one from which we usually look at things as a way of, number one, like Pema Chodron says, if you're doing this social engagement work, you know, unified mind, non-dual thinking, okay, fully committed heart, without attachment to outcome. So we get in there and we spend just as much of our time as we can being antibodies, and as little of our time and activity being pathogens, and hope that if enough of us are doing this on a continuous basis, we're going to begin to affect the change that we seek. There's kind of a parallel teaching, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, that it can also be helpful as far as that change in perspective is concerned. And it's the teaching of the three kayas. And Luke or others who are actually better schooled in the Mahayana tradition than I am can help correct me if I go off the deep end. But kaya means body. Okay. So the three kayas, nirmanakaya, sambhogakaya, and dharmakaya, okay, are these three embodiments or emanations of Buddha nature. So, nirmanakaya is the body of the Buddha in human form, okay, or a realized being in human form. Sambhogakaya is what at least the tantric masters that I've received teachings from sometimes refer to as the rainbow body, which is to say an energetic body, okay, that is kind of overlain on the physical body. Okay, so it's related to it, energizes it, but it's also to some extent distinct from it. Okay. So, for instance, all these stories of the sort of out-of-body experiences of people under surgery of being able to, their consciousness has gone someplace outside the body. There's something about an energetic aura around the body that allows for this kind of flexibility of consciousness to occur. The Dharmakaya is the one great body of which we are all a part. Okay. Except the language is misleading because none of these is actually a thing, right? It's also a process, and the great Dharmakaya is said to be empty and said to be without essence, except it's there, right? And it is essentially the collective emanation or expression of the Buddha nature of all things. So taken from that perspective, you know, when we are realizing our Buddha nature, we are consciously part of the great Dharmakaya, part of this one great body. When we're not, when we're contracted and drawn back in and afraid or despairing or whatnot, we don't have access to that kind of great web of consciousness, great web of basically Buddha nature. Okay. So it's another way, again, of, and the language that expresses this, that I keep coming back to, is the phrases that are offered by a spiritual friend or a family member to somebody in the Tibetan tradition when they're dying. Okay. And they're what the words that are being read to them, "O nobly born, you who are the son or daughter of the Buddha, remember who you are in these times of change." Next phrase is, "Step out of the small self, this body of fear." In this tradition, they actually refer to the physical body as the fear body. Because it's the body that feels fear. It's the body with the discursive mind that is aware of its mortality. That is aware of here today, gone tomorrow. That is aware of all that arises must pass away, right? All compounded things are impermanent. Okay. And it's called a fear body because it doesn't want to die. You know, even for people who are dying a peaceful death and whatnot, if you've been with someone as their life is leaving them, there's usually this little window right there toward the end where the body is having none of it. You know? It's going to go down swinging, you know, so there can be a gasping for air or kind of a, you know, energy waves moving through the body because it just doesn't want to, you know, stop being. So that sense of the mortality of the body and the fear that it arises is where that phrase comes from. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, you know, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. So it's an invitation for the consciousness to expand beyond, to let go of the physical body, okay, and to move into this bioenergetic realm, okay, and then to become a part of the great Dharmakaya, to simply let go and flow into the primordial nature of the universe. So step out of the small self, this body of fear, rest in generosity and kindness of heart, rest in the dedication and compassion and wisdom that you share with all life. For that is who you truly are. Trust it and rest in your own true nature. So in doing this work, you know, we are also invited to step out of the small self, this body of fear, and acknowledge that we're part of Gaia, that we are indeed part of this thing that is so much greater than ourselves. And so if we want to incline the mind, if we want to incline, you know, bodhicitta, the Buddha nature of mind, okay, toward this important work, then it's really useful if we can do it from this perspective. We're all in this together. We're going to work together as hard as we can to try to protect all life on Earth, and then things will unfold as they will. And if they don't go in a way that looks good for our species, it will not have been for lack of our effort to keep things healthy and well. Any more comments about those two sets of ideas side by side? Yes, please.
I studied economics, and economists are always going back and forth about the short run and the long run.
Yes.
And what we do in the short run affects the long run, and vice versa. But my favorite economist said, in the long run, we're all dead.
Yes, of course, right. Is there another comment? Yes, please.
Well, when we think of humanity, we think of ourselves as average humans. But one other hopeful aspect of humanity are those great beings, the Buddha, who are also here concerned about the earth. So there are those who are at a level of evolution that is higher than the ordinary one, that are also concerned and putting their energy into keeping Earth alive and viable for all beings.
Right.
So that's a hopeful reminder that we have help.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I personally, I'm finding, you know, I've been very politically and legally active doing environmental advocacy. Anymore, I'm finding myself much more drawn to doing more environmental chaplaincy work, which has got to do, you know, because, you know, the feelings of despair or loneliness or whatever, they're very natural given the information we're being. So what's going on for me, and I think for a lot of us when we look at it, is actually every bit as much a spiritual crisis as it is an environmental one. And in order for meaningful environmental change to occur, there probably has to be some kind of spiritual renewal happen, but not necessarily attached to any one religious tradition. And so, you know, for instance, John Muir is, you know, one of the founders of the Sierra Club. He was a brilliant political strategist, but he was also, I think, probably Euro-America's first eco-chaplain. You know, because he spoke very forthrightly about the nature of the human spirit and how contact with nature is essential to a healthy human spirit. And a healthy human spirit that is in an intimate relationship with nature is absolutely necessary insofar as the conservation of the earth is concerned. Because you don't take care of something you don't love. And so what he was spent all of his life trying to do is help people fall in love with the earth. And some of the people that he helped fall in love with the earth and spend lots of money, you know, buying up lands for national parks were also the ones who were despoiling the earth, you know, like the Rockefellers and others. And so in some ways he was probably guilt-tripping them for the harm he knew they were doing. But he would take these people, you know, anyone who he organized these trips, he'd take them up to the Yosemite Valley or anywhere where they could just be awestruck and say, oh my goodness. You know, we didn't know this is here. You know, you've got to hang on to this. This is our heritage. You know? Yeah,
I'm not sure it's still in existence because the founder passed away. But in California, there was an NGO called the Institute of Reverential Ecology. Uh-huh. So these movements that are small, you know, are happening in all over the world in various ways and in various traditions.
Yep.
You know.
And more and more they're starting to come together. I mean, I think that's, as Donna's pointing out, I think that's another reason for there to be real hope. You know, somebody estimated there are actually about 2 million organizations in the world right now that one way or another are working on issues of environmental sustainability. Mm-hmm. And another comment about economics came to mind, Bill was talking about, you know, among the most influential books, of course, in the history of economic thought in the Western world, is Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. So people chat up that book a lot, but they don't chat up as the other book that he wrote at the same time, you know, or around the same time. It's called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, you know. And in that, he basically said, not in so many words, but that if his writings on, you know, the hidden hand of the market and basically the dynamic stasis of macroeconomic systems, you know, he said, without moral guidance and moral restraint, that system is a soulless monster. So I think he was concerned by that time about these ideas that were being unleashed on the European colonizing nations of the time. That, you know, if you go with that story and that set of ideas without accompanying the others, you're going to wreck the place. And that seems to be pretty much the way it's come to town. So, over here.
This is sort of an aside. I was camping this week and thinking a lot about activism,
yeah,
about climate change. And I think because I was in nature and just being very observant and very present, I kind of had a shift, and that is I felt like I need to feel like I don't have to do it all. Mother Earth,
yes,
is doing this for us all the time.
Absolutely.
Mother Earth has done so much for us, just all the time.
Yes.
So it helped me somehow.
Right. You know, the earth will endure one way or the other. You know, we have several million years of evidence to that. And we can do what we can to help that process along. And then that's it. One of the, Bhikkhu Anālayo, one of the teachers I find particularly inspiring these days, when we, some of us in a teacher's reunion retreat, met with him in June, and asked him about the teachings that he was giving with regard to, Theravada teachings with regard to working with the climate emergency. And he really suggests, he said, one of the pretty important ones is what in the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, this is called the charnel grounds contemplation, or the charnel grounds meditation. And that's one in which if there are bhikkhus, you know, meditators who are really attached to the body, you know, really imbued with a lot of lust and just can't let go of the idea that the body is going to die, then they go to the place where they dispose of dead humans, right? And different traditions do it differently. Like in Tibet, they just chop them up and put them on a big platform to feed the vultures. You know, so it's kind of carrion bird food. But at least it recycles the body. It has value, you know, before it gets too rotten. And so why not help nature's recyclers live a happy life? And so that's what they do with the body. Down in India, they would chop it up and burn it, you know, and how fancily they did it would depend on how wealthy the person was, you know, how elaborate the ceremony was. But he would have them go and watch people, especially the ones that couldn't afford big fancy funeral pyres afterwards, just kind of watch the body rot before they set fire to it. And as a way of just remembering the inevitability of, you know, the words that were spoken when the Buddha died, all compounded things are impermanent. They arise and they pass, for that is their nature. Those who remember this teaching experience the highest joy. So he was saying, you know, we have to acknowledge the possibility. You know, we know we're all going to die individually. We have to acknowledge the possibility that we aren't going to make it as a species, you know, and do what we can to make our peace with that possibility so that we're not continuously living in a state of fear and panic of what might happen, you know, because it might. And it's worthy of opening the mind to that so you're not afraid of it all the time. Okay, we don't know. We really just don't know. All we can do is do our best in the moment. Now, of course, you've gone and burned through another perfectly good 2 hours. So let's retake our sitting postures just for a moment. O nobly born, you are the son or daughter of the Buddha. Remember who you are in these times of change. Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. Rest in the compassion, the dedication, the equanimity that you share with all life. For that is who you truly are. Rest in it. Trust it. Abide in your own true nature. Have a safe journey home. See you in a couple of weeks.